If something's lacking, we say in Burmese, we say pore. And pore literally means it's too light.
Add stock instead of salt because it has the flavour enhancer already in it.
You know, we would never really use kind of MSG in our home cooking, which I find quite interesting that we would feed it to people.
Pretty much the only season we use is a little bit of salt and a little bit of MSG.
This is To Be Delicious. My name is Dr. Anna Sulan Mussing. I'm a writer and academic who is particularly interested in looking at ingredients as a way to understand the world we live in. This podcast is a Lekker mini-series looking at the food heritage in the UK through the lens of umami and the ingredient MSG. Across 5 episodes, we speak to a number of chefs, academics, cooks, and bartenders from a variety of different heritage and backgrounds to explore some of my research into how MSG has been part of our cultural heritage. Lucy and I are standing on a freezing cold platform in Cardiff Central Station. We're on our way to meet Angela and her mum, Jin Tian Hoi. Angela's book Takeaway about her experience in a Chinese takeaway in South Wales has shone a light on life behind the counter and opened countless readers' eyes to the story behind their weekly takeaway order, including the racism Angela and her family experienced.
We are now approaching Pontyclun.
But something else that's really important in takeaway is the care and skill that went into cooking the food. Often, Chinese takeaway food can be taken for granted, but the work that goes into creating the flavour combinations of the signature dishes shouldn't be undervalued.
Morning! Well, thanks for picking us up.
Hi, Anna.
Lucy. Lucy. Nice to meet you.
Angela and her mum have kindly agreed to spend the day with us, showing us around the village where they lived and worked, and making us lunch, as well as sitting down for a proper conversation, with Angela also acting as an interpreter for her mum. I wanted to see for myself the takeaway that Angela brought to life in the pages of her book, and try to understand the experience of cooking and eating the food that her family brought to this place.
But this is the village that I grew up in, so it's meaning grapes and mulch, because there's a lot of grapes.
So this is like the high street?
Yeah, so this is the high street in where I grew up in South Wales, in Bather. But this part is Tennant, which is like the lower part of Bather, and it's very residential, so it's a main street and it's mainly all kind of terraced housing. I think this was probably old terraced housing for the coal miners, so the street over is the old coke woods, and it's still there. You could break into it if you want to go in, but I
we're not going to do that.
We're not going to do that, I promise. Not today, but you can kind of see it in the distance anyway. You can see these big pillars. It's kind of a scar on the of old coal mining community, and most places in South Wales still have these old coal like coke works, but in a way I kind of find them ugly beautiful because it kind of shows you the history of it, what this place used to be. Even though it looks very grey, it's, you know, it's rough around the edges, and I think it's kind of beautiful in its own way. But yeah, we're on the main street here, and the high street has hairdressers on the corner, a dog groomer, another hairdresser. Like I said, I think there's a huge amount of hairdresser to people ratio in South Wales. I don't know why. And then there's Lucky Dragon, which was our old Chinese takeaway, which is by the new owners. I think it used to be called Yummy Yummy, but our old Chinese takeaway was called Lucky Star. And then next to it is a carer's home, and then another hairdresser, an Indian takeaway, and a fish and chip shop, a co-op, and probably another barber's as well, and a pharmacy on the end. The Indian takeaway and the fish and chip shops have been here for a long, long time. I think they've been there before we came in. But we moved here since 1988, on the 8th of August.
Ooh.
The luckiest day of the century.
Yeah, yeah. Amazing.
standing outside the old shop now, you can kind of see. Maybe we can peer into the counter. That's fine.
Have they changed much inside?
No, it looks exactly the same. It is exactly the same. So it's like red brick counter, kind of white tiles, and then there's like this creamy brown kind of floral tiles. And there's like a big... Is the menu still there? I'm peering into the window, which is probably not very good. But there's a big menu on the left-hand side, and then behind is probably a TV. Yeah, my mum is saying it's exactly the same as well. They haven't changed much. But yeah, and then behind that door is, you know, behind the counter, and then there's the kitchen. So it's a long kind of hallway, and then on the left is like a tiny, tiny little living room, sitting room. I mean, we stuffed like two sofas and a telly, and then you have to climb over each other to get in. It's a very small kind of box room, and then you've got the big kitchen in the back, which is the wok burner range, little silver island, then there's red quarry slip tiles, and then there's like a little sink on the side, and then a hallway into the back, and then there's like a little garage. And then the garage would just be like extra storage space for Tupperware, for containers, lids, that kind of thing, more kind of packaging essentially that we can't fit into our tiny space. And then upstairs has two bedrooms and a bathroom, but yeah, it's not that big really. When you look at it again, you think like it was the biggest thing in the world at the time, and then you come back, it's almost like, wow, it's like it's exactly the same as how it is, you know, like so much has changed but so much has stayed the same. How many years? Like 30 years we ran it. Yeah, so 30 years my parents ran it for, and then I was pretty much born here.
Oh, nice to meet you. Yeah, I haven't seen her in a while.
Yeah, but she used to look after us when my parents were busy. She's on the opposite road. She'd pop in for a time and then she'd like look after us for a bit.
Oh, nice.
So I think here is, you know, not just in Bather, I think loads of places up and down South Wales. It's an incredibly hard place to live, you know, especially unemployment rates being really high. There's not that much going on. You know, there's a lot of drug problems. There's a lot of teenage pregnancy. And it's tough, you know, but I think it's one of those places where you kind of make something out of nothing, regardless of how difficult it is to find work, difficult it is to find something to do. There's not much culture, there's not much things going on, or like economy. I think people just kind of make do with what they have. In a way, that's really nice, in a way, like, because I think that's what makes people in Wales the friendliest. This is what I think. I'm biased. I don't know, there's this kind of determination and perseverance with a lot of Welsh people, I think. Like I said, everyone kind of knows everyone, and all the customers that came through the door were just, they actually genuinely had interest in our lives. You know, they saw me and my brothers grow up behind the counter, and you know, they still keep in touch with my mum and my parents. They're like, oh, how is so and so doing, are they in university yet, or like that kind of thing. And then you'd care about them and their family, and you know, it was so much more than just a place to go to get food or to get, you know, your weekly kind of Chinese takeaway. It was a place where people can just come and talk. You know, it was the after party for the pubs when the pubs closed, or whenever there's a match day, you know, people go mad, go for a drink, and then come for a Chinese.
Back at Angela's childhood home, we sat down at the table to be served tea and her mum's incredibly delicious pumpkin cake. Although Angela's mum and dad sold their original takeaway years ago, she still works in the restaurant business. And we get straight into talking about MSG.
Oh, 即是一台客試一下,不要放的,然後那台客回來 compare 到死了。
So my mum was saying, so she now works at a Japanese restaurant. She used to work with like our family friends, Chinese takeaways, but work with family is sometimes drama, so that's why my mum was like, oh, you know, I'll work far, like, removed.
So she works with, like, family friends. They own a sushi place in a City Road in Cardiff, which is, like, a main kind of student area. So she works there as, like, a prep chef now. And she was saying that her boss at the sushi place, I think he's quite adamant on not using MSG in his food, which I was questioning. I was like, why wouldn't he use MSG? But she was saying there was an incident at the sushi place, and then her boss was like, I'm not going to put MSG in food from this point out. And then there was a customer that complained, like, the food tastes really bland. Like, what has changed? And then he wanted to kind of do an experiment. And he was like, well, we'll teach, like, we'll show you, we'll do a meal without MSG and then one with MSG. And they were like, yeah, obviously we prefer the one with MSG. Like, it tastes so much better. And they actively complained, like, it can taste difference with or without MSG, which I think is quite interesting. So the boss was, like, lying and then said that, oh, we, you know, our normal chef wasn't here. Actually, the one that normally uses MSG, which I just think is really funny. 那你煮东西会不会多少用美食呢?
即是如果在店里又一定要用
So whenever she is working in the shop, she would use MSG, because I did ask her, like, do you use MSG?
因为那些客人已经习惯了，我们放一匙羹盐就要放一匙羹味精，一样。So I think the customers
are quite used to the taste of MSG within their food already without even realizing it.
And do you remember as a child growing up in the takeaway, the conversation around MSG? Or was it sort of in the background and not really part of?
I think it was always there. You know what I mean? Like, we've always used MSG. And I think the first time that I came across MSG, I just mistook it for salt because it looks exactly like salt. And when you see it in a large quantity, I guess you wouldn't normally see it in a large quantity in a home kitchen. But when you see it in a large quantity in a shop, so it's all these containers, it would be like salt, there'd be MSG, there'd be sugar, these kind of three kind of grainy seasonings. If you look closely enough, you can kind of see the differences, because MSG is like slightly longer, it's almost like sprinkles, and then salt is more of like a shorter kind of grainy-ish texture, so like salt is more kind of towards sugar. Because they're always together, when you're seasoning stuff, we would always say often get them mixed up. They're quite interchangeable, those three. So I think with growing up, with our home cooking, you know, we would have family meal before service. We would often cook quite healthily. We would have, like, steamed rice, whole steamed sea bass with ginger and spring onion, like pork and some choy and some vegetables. It was always very balanced, like protein, carb, and some vegetables. And, you know, we would never really use kind of MSG in our home cooking, which I find quite interesting that we would feed it to people. Because of my mum's, like, rural upbringing in China, you know, she grew up on a farm that was quite poor, and you know, they didn't have a lot of food, and, you know, MSG was never a thing that they could afford. That was a luxury product. And within my mum's cooking, she would always have kind of like a master stock that they would use, keep topping it up, and that would kind of be the base of all the flavourings for their cooking and the food. And that just kind of what she learned from her grandmother and her family and relatives. You know, there wasn't as much choice, there wasn't as much kind of see, like, whatever was available at the time. So that's kind of her mindset in terms of cooking. She would be like, well, it's already quite flavoursome anyway, the master stock that we would use for, like, the base of sauces or the soups or, you know, even in stir fry. So that's why she would never really use MSG within her cooking.
For anyone who's read Angela's book Takeaway, you'll be familiar with her mum's garden. In it, Angela describes how she would carefully, tenderly train vines along makeshift trellises made from scrap wood and bed frames, even though it was December when we visited, and from a glance out the window it looked like there wasn't much to see. We asked whether we could take a tour, and it turned out, thanks to Angela's mum's skillful growing, there was much more going on than meets the eye, beginning with some unassuming looking pots topped with water in the corner of the garden.
Oh, the sun's coming up.
Yeah. We've been blessed, to be honest.
Yeah, I know, we've been very lucky.
She'd
like pour off the top of the water and then they're growing underneath the soil, as you can kind of see. You don't have to.
Oh, cool.
She's going to get one of hers. You don't have to.
Let me see.
Have I 捉熟了?
不是竹笋啊，是一个果仔咯。
Oh my god.
Oh, yeah.
So it's like a type of root, I think.
看下有冇啊？睇下有冇先。I don't know.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Kind of see. It's like a it's root.
Yeah, Lee.
Yeah. Oh, that's it. Is it water?
嚟一個啦。
Yeah, I think it's a water chestnut.
Yeah, 係唔係 water chestnut？
咩咧？
係 water chestnut.
Yeah, it's a little water chestnut. So it looks like it's not growing.
Looks like a chestnut.
Yeah,
yeah, yeah. Looks chestnut.
Yeah.
不过我哋
做 what life was like in China when she grew up was, you know, and this is like before, just before the civil revolution, like the cultural revolution happened, but, you know, she had a very nice, like, lovely time on the farm before, you know, the civil war happened, and it was very self-sufficient.
Yeah, yeah. 即是个意思，这个是另外，这个是事故定啊，我哋叫做。
Okay, so she said,
it's like a chestnut,
but you would have it for like Chinese New Year to have it, because it looks like a penis.
Yeah, I got that.
And it would represent fertility.
But,
yeah, so this is a baby one, so that would kind of grow a bit longer.
Yeah.
If you want a fire, you have to go chop wood. If you want a water, you go get it from the streams or you get it from the ocean and you boil it down to clear of any impurities and make it kind of drinkable. Vegetables and anything, you'd grow it yourself. Like sugar, you'd grow it from like sugar cane. So I think everything was just, you know, there wasn't many jobs or, you know, there wasn't much money because people didn't have any jobs. But it was kind of interesting to hear her say that there was a lot of the way that they would make money or sustain is through kind of trading goods with one another. So she knew the fishermen had fish, so they were like, oh, I can sell you some vegetables and we'll trade for goods. Or, you know, we knew the kind of farmer, oh, you've got animals, we've got this and vegetables. So it's a very, you know, very simple time, but it's incredibly, you know, everything is kind of its own little self-sustaining system. Like, you wouldn't have to rely on, going to a supermarket or a thing, like, where everything is pre-packaged and readily available for you. Like, it's such a different time to what it was then.
Oh, goji berries. Oh, wow.
So they're goji berries.
She would normally
have goji berries on, like, a little soup. She'd have it for, like, porridge and breakfast every day, but she would kind of harvest a lot of them, then put them in the freezer, and then use them for whatever she needs to.
This
watercress.
This
is really good for like soups. Yeah. Like, I really love kind of pork bone and watercress soup. Oh, that's so good. But it's almost like peppery kind of. It's good for coughs, like when you have a sore throat or cough, so it just clears that passage out.
It's growing so well.
Yeah.
Like, so it's good.
She's like, oh, I harvested quite a lot, but there's they kind of grow a lot. I mean, it doesn't look like there's a lot, but the
clear just hibernating.
I'm curious to ask your mum
about
how cooking, when you first came to the UK and you're cooking in the different Chinese restaurants, was it a very different style of cooking and how did you learn to do that?
咁你第一次嚟英國咧，咁你煮飯咧喺中國到依家喺啊外賣檔嗰啲咧，咁你煮飯咧會點同咧？
即係中國煮嗰啲咧就
係。Yeah, so like in you know when you're cooking in like China, it's again it's like tailored to what they were like or what we would like in our preferences. So I think like Chinese cooking is very much more like they eat for health, like it's very in tune with like your body and it's kind of really drilled into you from a very young age. You know, they teach you a lot about nutrition and health, and I think when in like Chinese culture is when you eat, it's like you think of your body as like the yin and yang, the, you know, the heating and cooling of your body, and like too much heating foods is bad. You're gonna get out, like you're going to get breakouts, you're going to get spots, you're going to feel lethargic, you know, and tired. But when you eat too much cooling, it's also not very good for you. So you need to always kind of balance that within your body. So, you know, that's the kind of, whenever people eat in like China, it's always thinking about body, like health. I don't know if it is still for the next generation, but for definitely my mum's generation, she always cooks with health in mind. when she came to the UK, I think, you know, it was very adapted to what people would like, essentially. So, again, like I said, like a lot of fried foods. You know, she would kind of learn to kind of see what people were ordering and kind of change what was selling well, what wasn't selling well. And she'd also kind of see, because we lived on the main street, she can kind of, I think we even like went to the the fish and chip shop to see what they would do, like their processes and learning from them. You know, they would kind of have a fish and then they would batter it, then fry it, and then season it. Whereas I think my mum would, whenever they would fry stuff, they'd be like, oh, it's all about kind of marinating, you know, using whenever you're frying fish, there'd always be kind of like MSG, salt, sugar, and then kind of marinate the meat first before kind of like battering it. So it's always kind of soaking up whatever is around you and then kind of cooking back to kind of tastes and whatever people would like, what is best selling, what isn't. And I remember that we would also, you know, we often kind of adapt the menu a lot. And a lot of people were kind of customizing their own orders already, because people would, in a way, like they would have fried rice and noodles, but they're like, oh, can I have it with like half and half? Can I add this and this? So like people were already customizing it without us even doing it. And then until we kind of caught on, like, oh, actually, people want to try a bit of everything. So why don't we do this half and half dish, which I still remember the number is A8. You know, all the numbers are still drilled into me. So it's like, yeah, A8, which would be like half rice, half chicken curry or beef curry. And then sometimes people would want to add chips with it. And then we'd also do, like later on, we introduced like kind of these variety meals where you also get like fried rice, bit of noodles, like a spare rib, a chicken ball, onion ring, you know, a bit of everything. And they were really, you know, popular because people wanted to try a bit of everything, but without kind of fully committing to the full dish. Yeah.
Mm, very entrepreneurial.
Yeah, my mum was incredibly entrepreneurial. Yeah,
that totally goes against the idea of what people think of Chinese takeaways or Chinese restaurants, because it's like it's thought of as quite formulaic, or like, oh, it's just fried food that's being made. It's all like frozen, prepackaged, etc., and forgetting about the labour, the creativity, the entrepreneurialness to all of it.
My mum would say, like, yeah, a lot of people forget that there's so much prep work that goes into it. You know, it's not just the hours that you open. You know, we open from 5 p.m. to 11 p.m. but I think I remember my mum saying, like, she would wake up at like 6 a.m. every day and then go to bed at like 2 a.m. you know, that was her life for like 7 days a week and 364 days a year.
We've already touched on how Angela's family wouldn't put MSG in the food they cooked themselves at home, mostly because it wasn't something they'd grown up with in China. So I was curious to know what they really thought about it and where that impression had come from.
There was always, from my parents' point of view, I think there was always a mentality of like MSG is bad for you. It's the myths that my, you know, parents would see from China, because we would have Chinese TV in our household. We would watch TBB, which is like a Hong Kong Chinese channel, and we get news and we get the cartoons. That's how I kind of learned how to speak Cantonese, is via TBB, watching that in the house, watching old cartoons. And then we'd always get news and stuff. I think there used to be a incident in the news, I think it was like in the 90s, with a Maggi seasoning, and they recalled a product. It was a long, long time ago, and they probably, you know, changed it now. But then that was such a huge scandal. And I think it's always those things when you have kind of product and food scandals, and that kind of forever changes the reputation, or like, oh, I'm never using that again. It makes your hair fall out. Like all these kind of crazy myths that aren't really backed up or scientifically proven. And I think we used to use Maggi seasoning a lot in a lot of things, and that is, you know, MSG essentially, you know. But my mum would be like, oh no, it makes your hair fall out. And I think it's because of all these, you know, what you see in the news or like product recalling, and it's almost like, oh, I'm just gonna lump everything in that and then have all these kind of myths tied into that.
How did MSG get such a bad rap in the first place? Back in 1968 in New York, Dr. Robert Kwok wrote into the New England Journal of Medicine, into the letters section, that he was getting headaches, racing heart, numbness at the back of his neck, and other mild ailments after eating at northern Chinese restaurants in New York. He suggested three things that might have caused this: salt, cooking wine, and MSG. He posed this as an open question without real accusation. The editor of the journal titled this letter Chinese Restaurant Syndrome. This was then taken up by mainstream media, and the story ran riot and crossed over to the UK and beyond. There are a couple of nuanced aspects to the story, including that this letter section was often a place for humour and non-serious banter. Anyway, as they say, the rest is history. Some of that history is, of course, incredibly racist and dark. There has been an incredible amount of work from scientists, academics, journalists, and chefs that have counteracted this narrative and proved it false. Chinese Cooking Demystified's YouTube video is one of my favourite deep dives, covering history, class, and with a global nuance to the story. And I highly recommend you just Google the history of MSG. Getting back to Angela, I wanted to know whether it felt like behind the takeaway counter, she was at the forefront of how this misinformation has a real-life impact on East and Southeast Asian communities, and also her work as a journalist has extensively covered East and Southeast Asian food culture in the UK. So I asked her how she sees MSG's place within Britain.
And obviously you've done quite a lot of research and looked into MSG now in a contemporary context. How do you see it and its place in culture, in British food culture?
What a great question. I think it's such a, I don't know, I feel like because it's such a complex thing and it's such a, I feel like with MSG, it's such a bad rap here. Like, rap? it gets such a bad reputation here. And it's mainly, like you said, people's first introduction of MSG, willingly or unknowingly, is through kind of Chinese takeaways. And, you know, I think it wasn't until kind of all the news that was spread. I think it was more so in the US, you know, with the Chinese Restaurant Syndrome saying, like, oh, I've got headaches, I don't want to eat Chinese food, and it was being correlated. I do find that kind of came over across the pond, and then people were like, oh, maybe I do get headaches. But I think people are kind of slowly opening up and like being more open about it, especially, you know, from videos that I watch on like TikTok or social media. Everyone is like using MSG is now like the cool thing to do. What's that cucumber guy that I keep seeing? You know, he's just like mandolining like cucumbers and then like putting gochugaru, gochujang, MSG, obviously, like that's what he would say. And you know, people always ask, like, what is MSG? Like, this is really like this new kind of novel product which has been around for a long time.
Logan, a social media influencer, is a good example of showing who gets to use MSG without repercussions and without needing to explain and contextualize it.
This is the kitchen. Okay. This is where I did all the recipe testing.
Oh, wow.
In this tiny space.
Yeah.
It's chaos. There's just so much stuff here. Yeah. I feel like my mum is a hoarder.
Okay. Yeah, what did you bring up?
But we are doing some clay pot rice.
Yeah.
This is
half of it.
Jasmine rice?
Yep. Bata.
Two types of grains of rice. And then you just wash it. And you rinse it under the tap about 3 times. You just use your kind of hand to agitate the grains to wash it, to get all the, I don't know, what is on the rice grains?
Starch.
Like starch, yeah. So you get rid of the starch and then the water would go cloudy and then you just drain off the cloudy water. And then you do it a couple of times.
And the difference between the food you ate at home and obviously the food then you cooked, and you're saying using MSG and not using MSG, how did those two kind of different Chinese food identities mix or talk to each other in your kind of culinary knowledge or history landscape?
So she's washed the rice, but she's already prepped all the pork. The Chinese pork belly, well, like the lap yong, which is Chinese bacon. So that's the stomach, and then she dried it herself. So usually she would, I don't know if you've seen the photo of it before, she made Chinese bacon, well it's like lap yong, which is the cured Chinese bacon, and then she makes it into like sausages, and then you like hang it out to dry. She used the like washing rack to dry that. A lot of people look down on British Chinese takeaway food, which is really sad.
You know, even, I think it's because they're like, it's not authentic. I hate the word authentic, but, you know, they're like, it's not the real deal that I got in the streets of Hong Kong. It's not the real deal as I got from the streets of, you know, Malaysia or whatever. It's like, I'm not sitting on a plastic stool in like 30 degree heat. Like, obviously, it's not that. Because nothing is authentic. You know, one person's authentic is one person's inauthentic. And it's kind of this made-up word that doesn't really mean anything.
It is. Let's put a little bit of oil on. Not a lot of oil.
Yeah.
And then I think she's already prepped some spring onion oil. So that's a bit more fragrant. So basically she was just like chop loads of spring onions, put it in oil so that you get that, imparted that flavour in the spring onion. And this is dried shrimp that she's pre-chopped already. This is called bao heng, which means like literally translated into called like exploding into aroma. Is what the actual word is. But you use that a lot in Cantonese cooking.
So I think, you know, I think because British Chinese takeaways get such a bad reputation of being this kind of deep fried, beige, greasy, it's not very good for you. But I think people have to realise that British Chinese takeaway food was created by Chinese people for white people. And it's their invention and taking what they've learned from, you know, the Dai Pai Dongs, which is like the outdoor wok street cooking in Hong Kong.
Oh, it's exploding everywhere. Sounds like Sai Fo Dia.
It's like
popping corn.
Popcorn, yeah.
So you've got similarities, very wok stir-fry cooking. So like chop sueys, you know, sweet and sour porks, and like chops, I've said chops, like fu yang, which is like the egg, and, you know, mixed vegetables and noodles, like all cooked in the wok and fried rice. These are the things you would normally get in a kind of a street kind of restaurant in Hong Kong, and they'd kind of brought that over.
And then you pour the rice and the rice water together. I've never seen this method.
And, you know, initially Chinese takeaways and restaurants were not for the kind of British audience. They were initially for Chinese people, for the seamen who worked in the UK, who worked on the docks, who worked on the boats. And, you know, that's how kind of Chinatowns were created, essentially. They had all these restaurants that were mainly for Chinese people, you know, by Chinese people, for Chinese people. And then until it started to grow in popularity, people wanted to know more, and then that's how it kind of diverted, and then it's now its own unique thing. I think a lot of people don't give it credit for, in terms of its innovation, its kind of adaptability, using whatever ingredients was available at the time. You know, very like tin food stuff, so like bamboo shoots or water chestnuts, and, you know, like hardier vegetables like onions and peppers that you would get normally around here. Because in, you know, Hong Kong is a big abundance of like seafood and pork. So I think a lot of kind of changing to whatever you could get in the UK, which is a very hardy, cold environment compared to Hong Kong, that is a very tropical environment. I think a lot of Westerners would see Cantonese food as, oh, it's British Chinese takeaway food, like sweet and sour pork, or the prawn toast, or spring rolls. Those are Cantonese food, but there's so much kind of breadth in terms of Cantonese cooking. It's very healthy, and I think a lot of people don't take that for granted, like, they don't take that into account. You know, a lot of it is, you know, incredible kind of Asian greens. You've got soups, like Cantonese soup is such an integral part of the Cantonese diet. You would have kind of this, well, they call it bone broth now, which they package it up as bougie now. But you would have like Cantonese soups with tongs for like either before a meal or after a meal to help open up the stomach to kind of ready your body for appetite, or have it afterwards as a kind of help you digest. And, you know, it's when you think of a meal, it's very complete with a soup and a vegetable and a protein and a carbohydrate. So, yeah, I think it's made me realise that Cantonese food is so complex, rather than this kind of narrow view that people have.
So she said that the water is gone and absorbed into the grain. Absorbed into the rice. She's going to use a big steamer.
Oh, I see.
And then I think she'll steam it in the pot. Oh, so it's almost like a bain-marie in a way. This house gets very steamy from all the steaming, because my mum just steams everything. It's good for the skin.
You know, in London, I feel like there's sometimes a bit of a fetishization almost of, like, I know a different cuisine of, and, you know, like being very regional about Chinese cuisine and being things like that. Does that kind of, I don't know, knowledge, it's the wrong word, but like, are people more specific or more discerning or more knowledgeable or, you know, in Wales now, or is it?
I think slowly. I find it fascinating that in Pontypridd, which is a market town over from here, there's a Xi'an restaurant. You know, I would never have would have a Xi'an restaurant like 20, 30 years ago. And I think that's just kind of exploded now. Like you say, this whole different regionality. So I think people are kind of realising, oh, there's not just Cantonese food, there's Sichuan food, there's Hunanese, there's Xi'an, there's Lanzhou. Like, that's just a huge kind of diverse culture. But what kind of frustrates me is also how a lot of people are kind of almost like collecting it like Pokemon cards.
Exactly. I mean, that's what I mean by this fetishization.
Exactly.
I couldn't work out how
it's almost like, oh, yeah, I've ticked this off, I'm going to tick this off next. But I think there's also this kind of language around it that's frustrating for me, is that whenever we talk about these different regionalities of Chinese food, that's newer, modern, it's more digitized, it's more seamless to order things, you know, you can order things off, I think that was the Chinese food delivery app, like Food Panda, which is just like its own little ecosystem, which is kind of crazy, geared towards kind of the Chinese international students living in the UK. Like I said, it's just its own kind of little ecosystem. But there's this kind of mentality of when we talk about regional Chinese food, it's always a kind of free pass to kind of dunk on Chinese takeaways, you know, or Cantonese food, right? It's always like, oh, you're used to those bright orange, deep-fried, you know, artery-clogging morsels of food, but now there's this new Sichuan handful noodle, you know? It's so frustrating. It's like, you don't need to dunk on one thing to talk about the other thing. Like, both can exist, and there's space for both to exist.
She was like, if you wanted to impart more flavour into it, you can line the base with, like, lotus leaves. You know, the one with like the glutinous rice wraps that you have at line the bottom, and then that kind of imparts the flavour of the steam within it. So about 20 minutes and it should be done.
Wow.
Yeah. It's speedy. And then you add soy sauce, like light soy, dark soy, some sugar, yes, a spring onions, and then you mix it together. You need some try some vegetables with it?
Or no.
I think it's okay. Yeah, I think it's okay. Go, I can see.
Amazing.
When we walked around the village, there was a clear sense of community and affection for the place. But I wanted to know what it was like to grow up in her South Wales village and the experience of being Chinese in a white space.
It's really hard, you know, because you're always constantly walking around with a target on your back. You know, you're always going to be known as the Chinese family or like the Chinese takeaway family, even in like a school setting or just walking outside in a personal life. And it was incredibly difficult, you know. It's like so much of that you're like, I just want to run away from. I don't want to be known for just this one thing. Like, I'm so much more than just the Chinese takeaway girl who grew up behind the counter. And I've always wanted to try and, you know, carve a path out for myself or do something with my life, or like wanting to do that. So I think it was difficult, you know, growing up. I just really wanted to be desperately anywhere but here. And I didn't really appreciate where I was from, because it made you kind of, you know, a place that you want it so much to be your home, you want it to love it, and it doesn't really love you back, was kind of really difficult. And, you know, even in school, you know, I get bullied for it, and, you know, I could probably count the people of colour on one hand, and two of those are my brothers, so there was two other people out of colour, and one of them just happens to be my best friend as well, so I think it's one of those things, like anyone who looks anything a bit different, you know, even my friend who lives down the road, who is one of my best friends for years, and she's mixed race, she's, you know, she also got a fair abuse of stuff, you know, people calling her the P word and God knows what. And, you know, it's quite, you know, a sheltered way of thinking, and also kind of a very small world way of thinking. And I think I spent so much of my time as a kid to be someone I wasn't, you know, dyeing my hair all sorts of colour, smoking, drinking, and trying to fit in, and just trying to find my way in the world and basically be, you know, absolute rebel to my mum, who absolutely hated me. So growing up, I always, you know, butted heads because I was kind of at war with myself and at war with my kind of identity and culture and race. Being in those kind of two worlds that I write in my book, being in a space that is incredibly white and then being in at my home space that's incredibly Chinese, you know, learning two different languages, not really kind of being able to communicate either one very well. So I've always just felt so kind of confused in terms of, you know, who I was, what I was, like, am I Chinese, am I Welsh? I'm not really quite sure who I am. And especially whenever I went back to Hong Kong to see extended family, you know, I never really fit in either there either, because whenever I went to Hong Kong, my Cantonese is not that good. Or, you know, the way that I do my makeup, the way that I do my hair, it's a bit different from locals. And, you know, they can tell, like, oh, you're not from here, are you? You know, it's almost like instant from, like, accents or the isms that you would say. So you're kind of these two halves that never really make a full, like, a whole circle, essentially. And I think that with racism in this country, it always feels like a kind of three steps forward, two steps back situation. Like, oh, we're making so many strides in amazing areas. You know, we're more accepting than ever of different races and cultures. But also there is still that kind of ugly rising right-wing fascism that's happening where you're like, you're not welcome here, or, you know, go back to your country where you're from, or all these immigrants are taking over jobs, and, you know, the whole horrible incidents with the race riots burning down immigrant businesses, or, you know, especially in COVID as well, that kind of reared its ugly head on it, where people were kind of actively avoiding Chinatowns or, you know, vandalizing Chinese takeaways because of COVID, and any Chinese-looking-esque person would be kind of targeted. You know, there is some incredible work that's been done in terms of trying to be anti-racist. There's amazing literature that's been happening in the last 5 years. I think the publishing industry has changed a lot in terms of, like, what stories and who to tell. I mean, there's still a long, long, long way to go. But there's, you know, it's happening. And I'm doing a lot of work with the Welsh government and the DARPOL, which is the grassroots organisation in terms of being anti-racist in Wales, and WJC, which is the Welsh Exam Board. And, you know, we're actively changing literature within schools, and we're piloting it across 40 schools in Wales. It's still exactly the same as it was like 50, 60 years ago. It's still Shakespeare, it's Of Mice and Men, it's Kill a Mockingbird. You know, these are all great books. But, you know, it's still a very narrow mind of what kind of world it is. So we're changing it with working with like 5 different authors who are people of colour in Wales and who's had lived experiences. So that's why I mean, in a way, that is kind of like a 3 steps forward, 2 steps back. It is kind of great to see all the work, but there's always got to be something done, I think.
You mentioned the media, and you're talking about publishing, and I think that's one of the important things to look at, I guess, is this, the narrative, the kind of cultural narrative that's happening. And MSG, I think, is a really good point or a good narrative that kind of came into the sort of the consciousness of the British landscape, and how food attaches itself to identities, or identities get attached to food, and that shapes and molds narratives. And so you've got things like what happened with Foot and Mouth being blamed on Chinese restaurants. You've got MSG being kind of attached to this idea of like dirty, bad food for you, etc., etc. And how do you think, like, I guess, how do we counteract those narratives? And I guess one of the things is, you know, you might not have been necessarily aware of specifically an MSG narrative in the media, but it would have seeped in anyway, right? How do you think we can tackle that or change that? Or what are the ways that narratives can shift? Again, you've talked about, obviously, the schools.
Yeah. Yeah.
What other ways do you think we can, or have you seen, or would you like to tackle?
I think, where do you begin? I think it's because it's, I feel like it just keeps happening again. It's like, again, we're not really learning. There are so many incidents within food that, you know, the whole thing with, like, cultural appropriation, the whole thing about racist incidents, like you say, foot and mouth disease. There's also, I think it was like the bird flu, swine, like all these different flus, that pandemics within the food areas, essentially. Like, that's how COVID started, apparently. I don't know, actually. No one really knows unless you were in Hunan, in China, again, that kind of gave a lot of wet markets a bad name, you know, having these kind of raw meat in the market, and then people were just like, oh, that's where bats come from, and all this kind of myth, that kind of thing. If anything, if you go to a wet market in Asia, it's probably the freshest food you can go and get. It's probably the cleanest food that you're going to get. And it's also, you can see it being prepared and butchered. You can see the whole process of it. So it's incredibly transparent in a way. Not like in a supermarket, you're like, oh, I do. If you go to a supermarket and you pick up an egg, do you know how that hen hatched that egg? Like, you're not going to know. And do you know how that chicken was kind of looked after, what the environment was in? Like, you're probably not going to know that either. But that's not to say, like, wet markets are amazing, that kind of thing as well. But I think I honestly don't have the answer for it, because I feel like it just keeps happening so much. I think in terms of trying to break down and break through that cycle is to keep talking about it. I know it feels like it's almost like a catch-22 where we're just kind of going around in circles, but it is amazing that there's so many people who aren't afraid to call things out anymore.
Next time on To Be Delicious.
I think that it is something that I have always been aware of. I think certainly when I was a teenager, I was learning about cooking for the first time. I was learning about cooking at school. I was learning about cooking at home. There was a lot of misinformation, which is why, you know, why it's in a consciousness, why people discuss it, why people talk about it. But I remember like thinking, that's in the chicken salt at work and it tastes great.
To Be Delicious was presented by me, Dr. Anna Sulan Mussing, and produced for Lekker by me and Lucy Dearlove. Our original theme music was composed by Midori Yeager. Our podcast artwork was by Natasha Pang Lee. This project was made possible by the support of the European Committee for Umami and Ajinomoto. If you've enjoyed this series, you'll also enjoy my first book, Chinese and Any Other Asian, Exploring East and Southeast Asian Identity in Britain, out now, which you can order on the link in the show notes for this episode.